Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves program on New Year's Day. We're going to start off with some announcements. Jeb Bradley and Charles Bass will be on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio on Monday, January 3rd from 9 to 10 a.m. in case you have questions or challenges for them. On Tuesday, January 4th at 7 p.m., New Hampshire filmmaker Tom Jackson will be showing the film Worlds Apart, 9/11 First Responders Against War at the UU Church, 292 State Street, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. In New York City, a group of 9/11 first responders have called for nonviolent responses to the attacks. It is their belief that violence will only breed more violence and the cycle will go on and on. Worlds Apart focuses on these particular heroes of 9/11 and their lives since that tragic day. The documentary features footage from a peacemaking delegation that brought 9/11 EMT Megan Bartlett and Joe Public Films producer Tom Jackson to Afghanistan in May 2004. They met with Afghan first responders in an attempt to establish ties of friendship and to see if Afghan rescue workers were really so different than those in New York City. For more information, contact Amy Antonucci at 750-7506. On Friday, January 7th, at 6 p.m., there'll be a planning meeting of CECO's peace response at Carnan House, 206 Court Street, behind the UU Church, Unitarian Universalist, in Portsmouth. For more information, contact David at 749-9159 or email ddiam@ttlc.net. On Saturday, January 8th, from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., there will be a nonviolence training offered in Portsmouth before the counter-inaugural, led by Amy Antonucci of CECO's Peace Response and Sean Donahue, formerly of New Hampshire Peace Action. Nonviolence training mixes information, discussion, exercises, and role plays to learn about and explore what nonviolent activism is and how it's used, the role of affinity groups, consensus decision-making, legal issues, and more. This training is an important way to prepare for an action or to improve effectiveness and thoughtfulness as an activist. These are also life skills that are useful in other situations. For more information and to register, please contact Amy, amyla44@juno.com. On Saturday, January 8th, from 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., Left Out Working Session will be occurring with a potluck lunch in the Concord Library, 45 Green Street. The two issues they'll be focusing on are water privatization and Democracy Now! Radio, getting the show on New Hampshire Public Radio. For more information, contact Sue DeSeve, S-U-Z-Y-L-O-O-N, at AOL.com. That's S-U-Z-Y-L-O-O-N at AOL.com. On Sunday, January 9th, at 1 p.m., there will be a potluck peace party in Farmington, New Hampshire. For more information or to RSVP, contact Manny or Pat at 603-332-0732. On Thursday, January 10th, there will be a national anti-war protest in Washington, D.C. New Hampshire Peace Action is sponsoring buses from Portsmouth and Concord, New Hampshire, to the counter-inaugural anti-war protest and rally in Washington, D.C. For more information on the bus from Portsmouth, email Jamila at jamilla@wellinformed.org or call during the day 207-439-5800. Next, we have a piece from projectcensored.org. You can check this out at www.projectcensored.org/publications/2005. It says, Censored 2005, the top 25 censored media stories of 2003 to 2004. Number 1. Wealth inequality in the 21st century threatens our economy and democracy. Number 2. Ashcroft versus the human rights law that holds corporations accountable. Number 3. The Bush administration censors science. Number 4. High levels of uranium have been found in troops and civilians. Number 5. The wholesale giveaway of our national resources. Number 6. The sale of electoral politics. Number 7. Conservative organization drives judicial appointments. Number 8. Cheney's Energy Task Force and the Energy Policy. Number 9. Widow brings RICO case against U.S. government for 9/11. Number 10. New nuke plants. Taxpayers support industry profits. Number 11. The media can legally lie. Number 12, the destabilization of Haiti. Number 13, Schwarzenegger met with Enron's Ken Lay years before the California recall. Number 14, new bill threatens intellectual freedom in area studies. Number 15, U.S. develops lethal new viruses. Number 16, law enforcement agencies spy on innocent citizens. Number 17, U.S. government represses labor unions in Iraq in quest for business privatization. Number 18, media and government ignore dwindling oil supplies. Number 19, global food cartel fast becoming the world supermarket. Number 20, extreme weather prompts new warning from UN. Number 21, forcing a world market for genetically modified organisms. Number 22, censoring Iraq. Number 23, Brazil holds back in FTAA talks but provides little comfort for the poor of South America. Number 24, reinstating the draft. Number 25, Walmart brings inequality and low prices to the world. And in that same vein, next we have from workingforchange.com, the 2004 Media Follies, Most Overhyped and Underreported Media Stories of the Year, by Jev Parrish. For the ninth consecutive year, here's my list of the most overhyped and underreported stories of the year. Given the amount of hype and missing reporting in the mainstream American media, I'm sure to have forgotten a few. Send in your suggestions, and I'll run them in a future column. These are my attempts to restore some balance to a badly flawed media performance. The solution, happily, is as close as your computer. Virtually every country in the world now has an English language edition of at least one major media outlet. In particular, websites for British and American media, www.bbc.co.uk, www.guardian.co.uk, The Independent, The Daily Mirror, Le Monde, The Irish Times, and many others often provide international and even domestic U.S. reporting far superior to the pablum we receive here at home. There's also a healthy and vibrant alternative media here in the U.S. WorkingForChange.com, Alternet.org, CommonDreams.org, ZNet.org, and many others. Seek out other sources, weigh the differences, and make up your own mind. Happy New Year. So here they are, the year's most overhyped stories. John Kerry as a viable candidate. He got the Democrats' nomination because he was the candidate who could beat George Bush, and then turned around and ran a stunningly inert campaign all the way through September. It cost him the election. Ralph Nader as a threat to the Democratic presidential ticket. Who are they kidding? The economy is improving, then it's not, then it is, then it's not, then it is, then it's not. But Alan Greenspan says, and blah, blah, blah. Ah, stagnation. Only the U.S. media could make unemployment, high credit card debt, a sky-high federal deficit, kamikaze tax cuts, a record trade imbalance, and sagging corporate profits appear rosy. Let's cut to it. Capitalism is in a crisis that the Bush administration can't figure out how to fix. End of story. The Scott Peterson trial. Of all the murderers in the world, the U.S. media has obsessed over Peterson because he's photogenic, upper middle class, young, and white. The press should have given him one column inch, skipped the photo, and moved on to the next story. How about a nightly news story about a photogenic, white, mass murderer-in-chief? Or some coverage of Pinochet's indictment by the Chilean court? Or any of the pandemic of other guys who killed their spouses, girlfriends, ex-spouses, ex-girlfriends, or fantasy lovers. Ronald Reagan's death. Forget Iran-Contra, illegal wars, administration corruption, AIDS, and the me decade. Just remember that he was a really nice guy. Oh, and he single-handedly ended communism. But wait, communism can't have ended because this is exactly how such regimes rewrite history. Hail the great fallen helmsman, comrade leader Ronnie. Foreign terrorists. Because of constant repetition and misuse, this term is utterly devoid of meaning. Many Americans, however, now think that any foreigner is a terrorist. Mission accomplished. Anything the White House says about Iraq. It's time to stop treating these ridiculously optimistic, obtuse pronouncements as credible. Freedom is on the march? Please. Extreme weather hype. Get used to it. With global climate change, our future will be full of storms. Instead of hyping the storm du jour as a once-in-a-lifetime event, U.S. media outlets should be more honest. Local news shows ought to run regular features on how to prepare for this week's extreme weather change, with periodic tips on emergency preparedness. And here's the phone number for Vice President Dick Cheney's office. Let him know what you think about global warming, climate change, and the administration's energy policy. And here's some more most underreported stories for 2004. Global warming and climate change. No credible scientist disputes it any longer. Flooding, monsoons, droughts, intense heat waves, and the disappearance of fresh water sources will lead to the deaths of millions of people around the world. Not sometime in the distant future, but within our own lifetimes and the lifetimes of our children. The impact is not just a human one. It will also involve the extinction of nearly half the species that inhabit the planet, by some estimates. In addition, millions of people will become refugees, and these displaced populations will put a heavy toll on those of us who thought our wealth would protect us from the ravages of climate change. The global AIDS pandemic. From the lack of U.S. press coverage, you'd think AIDS has been conquered. Nothing could be further from the truth. The West has largely shirked its responsibility for combating the worst epidemic since the Black Death killed much of the population of medieval Europe, or the U.S. military deployed smallpox to wipe out the native population of the Americas. The Bush administration has insisted that U.S. government funds be used only for programs that promote abstinence. In addition, the U.S. government has hindered efforts to get generic AIDS drugs in poor nations in response to pharmaceutical companies who want to protect their profits. That's criminal behavior. Meanwhile, 30 years of neoliberal economic policies have dismantled the healthcare systems of underdeveloped and industrialized nations alike, and are largely to blame for all the money that must now be poured into basic infrastructure, like rebuilding health clinics in African countries. The human race should be ashamed. We should admit the mistake, open our wallets, and begin to tackle another problem that has a whole variety of solutions, in particular, the use of condoms, the manufacture of generic AIDS drugs, and the funding of social welfare programs. The resurgence of nuclear power. Leave it to the Bush administration to promote nuclear power as its green solution to global warming, particularly in export to China and other developing countries. So far, the U.S. media has allowed this to sneak under the radar, in spite of well-established and long-standing public opposition to nuclear power and the costly problems entailed with nuclear waste disposal. The politics and economics of oil permeate everything from the economy to foreign policy, but are never discussed directly by the media. From major pipeline deals between Russia and Japan to the influence of oil on U.S. intervention in the Middle East, to China cutting major deals with Latin America and African nations for long-term oil contracts, to the impact of burning fossil fuels on our environment, to misguided tax policies and our deteriorating highway system here at home, to massive oil spills in our increasingly polluted oceans and waterways, the U.S. press has managed to talk around the major topic. We are addicted to oil, and something must be done to wean us off this drug. Let's declare a war on oil. Continuing corporate scandals. The Enron and WorldCom scandals broke in the summer of 2001. Shortly thereafter, politicians and businessmen in Wall Street assured us that new regulations would make corporate scandals a thing of the past. Ha! Last week, the SEC announced that the mortgage giant Fannie Mae, which together with Freddie Mac, backs half of all the mortgages issued in the U.S., and they're involved in a new corporate scandal. Fannie Mae will have to recognize $9 billion in losses that they've hidden from the public since 2001. Yes, this accounting fraud, which rivals anything WorldCom or Enron did, has occurred in the last 3 years, in spite of a so-called crackdown on corporate crime. And it's received zero press coverage, except for a few small articles in the Wall Street Journal. For shame. Not every vote counts. Miscounts and accidents, that may or may not have been accidental, have been steadily oozing out of Ohio and Florida since the election, but tampering with voter registration lists and voter suppression techniques have also been widely reported. What it adds up to is an election process so riddled with fraud and error that it would shame most third world countries, and we're supposed to be a model for this stuff? South America stands up to Washington. Additional elections this year have meant a near clean sweep, the exception being Colombia, of South American governments by left-leaning candidates who have won office by campaigning against Bush and the neoliberal policies of the U.S. The result? An emerging global South bloc led by Brazil, Venezuela, and India that has brought free trade expansion via the WTO and FTAA to a standstill. Torture. The horrific Abu Ghraib scandal got plenty of attention, along with the Bush administration's ridiculous assertion that it was the work of a few isolated soldiers. But the systemic use of torture and prison abuse at Guantanamo, Afghanistan, and Iraq has now been documented far beyond question. Even less examined, that many of the torture techniques, and not a few of their practitioners, have been borrowed directly from federal and state control unit prisons, where such practices have been decried by Amnesty International and others for years. Anything that happens on the ground in Iraq, the use of napalm, white phosphorus, and cluster bombs in Fallujah, continuing evidence of prisoner abuse in U.S. detention centers in Iraq, the lack of foreign fighters among captured Iraqi insurgents, zero progress in reconstruction, major fraud and misappropriation of reconstruction funds, bombing of voter registration centers, and the assassination of candidates and party members, no voter registration at all in the Sunni Triangle, including Iraq's third largest city, Mosul, the massacre of civilians by hastily trained, poorly equipped Iraqi security forces and the combat weary, stressed out U.S. soldiers who oversee them, U.S. military policies that is copying failed tactics from the Israeli military's playbook for the West Bank and Gaza Strip, continued fighting in Fallujah, a relatively small city that was supposed to have been pacified 3 weeks ago, the list goes on and on. If it's negative news, the U.S. press doesn't report it, on the assumption that telling the truth might make the American people demand a full and immediate troop withdrawal from Iraq. The U.S. media has swallowed the Bush administration argument, echoed by John Kerry, that we must stay the course in Iraq, or the whole Middle East will go up in flames. And whose fault would that be, hmm? It's not the job of the U.S. media to worry about the consequences of failed U.S. foreign policy. The U.S. press should stop worrying about controversy and start doing its job, reporting the news, negative or not. Let the people decide. That's what real democracy is all about. You'll never guess who the 2004 Media Person of the Year is. John Stewart. The so-called fake news anchor is voted as the year's most influential figure in the media, beating out Tom Brokaw, Bill O'Reilly, and Dan Rather. Jon Stewart, the host of Comedy Central's The Daily Show, was named 2004 Media Person of the Year in the annual online poll held by I Want Media. Stewart was announced as the Media Icon of the Year on CNBC's Topic A with Tina Brown on December 19th. The readers of I Want Media nominated 30 candidates and sent thousands of hits to the internet poll held November 15th through December 12th, 2004. Stewart received more votes than any other figure on the list, which included media CEOs, journalists, television news personalities, and bloggers. Among the candidates, Roger Ailes, Tom Brokaw, Rupert Murdoch, Bill O'Reilly, and Dan Rather. In 2004, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, the popular Comedy Central program that lampoons news broadcasts, beat out traditional news shows to win the Television Critics Association's honor for outstanding news and information programming. The Daily Show has been cited as an alternative source of news for a growing number of young people. In October, Stewart engaged in a widely discussed on-air verbal sparring match with the hosts of CNN's Crossfire over journalism ethics. Many readers submitted comments for posting on I Want Media. Eric Alterman, the media columnist for The Nation, said of Stewart, "Literally, no one upheld the honor better of what remains of the media than did this fake news comedian. He is our leader. How pathetic is that?" Bonnie Fuller, the editorial director of American Media and the 2003 Media Person of the Year, observed that Stewart has, quote, "done the virtually impossible. Skewer the political process and the politicians and yet make it intensely important and relevant." Mark LaPointe, an assistant professor of media studies at Allegheny College, Meadville, Pennsylvania, wrote, "As a college professor, I can attest to the belief that Jon Stewart has energized young people to care about social and political issues and has fostered a growing belief in them that they matter and can impact change." Following Stewart, the figures who earned the most votes in the poll were, in order, Howard Stern, the shock jock who could help launch a new medium with his planned move to satellite radio in 2005, Karl Rove, the Republican strategist and so-called news manipulator behind President Bush's re-election campaign, Anna Mary Cox, the editor of the popular and influential political gossip blog Wonkette, and Janet Jackson, the performer who sparked the FCC indecency crackdown with her Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction. And here's a date to remember from 2003. On January 3rd, 2003, Brazil's new leftist president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, suspended purchase of 12 new fighter planes, saying that the money could be better used to relieve hunger. Next, we're going to get back to our environmental theme for the show with a song by Pierce Woodward, followed by an interview in a few minutes by Brian Gregg with a member of Save Our Groundwater. First, remember to commemorate January 7th, 1971, when federal courts forbid most uses of the pesticide DDT, 9 years after publication of Silent Spring by Rachel Carson.
The Clean Air Act has been in effect for over 30 years. I mean, it's not the best piece of policy protecting the air, but it's good. It's done a lot of good for this country, and rolling it back makes absolutely no sense.
They say we should plan to adapt to global warming as opposed to reducing our carbon dioxide emissions. It took them 25 years to admit that there was global warming, and now they're saying, oh, it's too late, now we should just adapt.
It's an international embarrassment. I mean, to think that almost every other country on the planet agrees that global warming is happening, that we're the major cause. We contribute, I think, 47% of the world's global warming gases, but we're only 4% or 5% of the entire population of the planet. Yet we won't even admit that it's a problem, and we're not even doing anything concrete to fix it.
Tends to ignore environmental issues unless they're extremely salient, just because it's not bleeding and it's not burning and it's not exciting on newscasts. However, in the long run, it's probably the most important thing for public health in America to realize what we're doing to our environment. As far as long-term is concerned, there isn't a more important issue.
I think 80% of the country is with us on these issues. It's just that it's not necessarily the thing that's talked about most at the dinner table. But if you ask any average American, I think they would agree that they want clean air and clean water for their kids and a safe place to play. It may not be the sexiest issue, but I think people would agree that it's pretty core. Are still oriented towards, well, we gotta treat it, we gotta fix that problem, we're solving cancer, we're ready to treat it. But I think, like, why don't we find ways of preventing it? We don't really have a precautionary principle in our country, and I think a lot of other nations actually operate on the precautionary principle, whereas we operate on the, yeah, let's put asbestos in the buildings, and, you know, we find out 20, 50 years later that causes cancer, well, you know, then we'll fix it, we'll find radiation therapy and all those other things. Clean up the power plants, we wouldn't be spending as much money on as much.
For Making Waves Radio. Public hearings were extended this week on a controversial plan by the USA Springs Company to withdraw as much as 300,000 gallons of water a day from a proposed site straddling the Nottingham and Barrington town lines. In July 2004, the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, known as DES, granted the company a conditional permit that would allow it to withdraw a total of up to 112 million gallons of water a year. This following 3 years of effort by the company two previous rejections from DES, and opposition from the towns of Nottingham and Barrington, as well as from many members of the public. Residents and town officials were concerned about the effect the operation would have on their only source of water, wells drawing from the same aquifer that USA Springs plans to tap. A group of concerned citizens formed in the summer of 2001 to challenge USA Springs' plan. The group is named Save Our Groundwater, or SOG for short. Bill McCann of Dover, a former state legislator, oversees SOG's relations with the state government. First of all, let's talk about the hearing this past Tuesday in Concord. Why was this timing and location a problem?
Well, in the past, all of our hearings had either been in Barrington or Nottingham, and usually we were given a period of 15 days, 30 days, 10 days notice so that people could be prepared. The letter went out on the 17th of December. SOG got its copy on the 21st, as I recall. There was very little notice, and it was in Concord during the week between Christmas and New Year's. Seemed to us as the last-ditch effort by the outgoing administration at DES to try to get something done. We were concerned that they would have the hearing on the 28th and then make a decision before January 6th. One of the things we were assured was that that wasn't going to happen, and they agreed after quite a bit of calls from legislators and state senators that the hearing would be extended and reopened again on January 26th in Nottingham.
DES has issued USA Springs a conditional permit to withdraw water from the site, meaning that the company could only start pumping water if it does certain things first. One of the main conditions is that USA Springs has to clean up contamination from a neighboring property. A multi-part question here. What kind of contamination is it, and how did it get there, and what effect could that contamination have on the communities in that area?
Well, the contamination is VOCs, which we believe came from activities that took place back in the 40s and 50s on the site. The impact on the community is troublesome because in the 10-day pump test back in 2002, the contamination spread from the Farnham property onto the USA Springs property in a period of 10 days during this test. One of the concerns we've had over since day one is because of the amount of water being drawn from the ground, what the impact is on the aquifer, and would the continuous pumping, in fact, contaminate the aquifer as the water moves because of the pulling out of the ground of this 300,000 gallons of water a day. So the impact, you know, in a 10-day period, at least according to the numbers that USA Springs has told DES, resulted in 2 million gallons of contaminated water that now has to be removed from the USA Springs site and the Just Cause Realty site.
And that, a couple things on that. Just Cause Realty, we spoke yesterday on the phone. Is a name of the deed holder to a property that is basically connected with the USA Springs operation. Is that right?
Our understanding and what DES has said on the matter is that USA Springs and Just Cause Realty are connected in some manner. The details of which probably aren't even relevant. They are connected. They're not denying that. But in fact, after the contamination happened, Just Cause Realty bought the property that used to be known as Farnham, and that's where the contamination was. And they bought it for about $14,000 an acre for contaminated land with a covenant of no suits against each other. It was a strange transaction, but it's a reality, and it's got to be cleaned up in one form or another, according to DES. And so we're hopeful that it will be at some point.
And VOCs, you mentioned the type of contamination involved, volatile organic compounds. I'm not sure exactly what that means, other than that they're pretty nasty. Could you say a little bit about what sort of pollutants would cause that contamination?
Well, it's a byproduct of manufacturing, and it can be a byproduct of garage operations, which might involve petroleum base also. What caused it? You know, I'm not 100% sure. I'm not a scientist, but I do know that the VOCs, as they're called, had a pretty high parts per billion in the testing. So both DES and USA Springs concluded that they had to be removed or be mitigated to the point where it would be safe for drinking water. There were discussions back and forth, and as it stands now, my understanding is USA Springs has said they will remove the 2 million plus gallons so that there won't be an impact on the site.
And if I understood correctly, the contamination was sort of on the land next to the place that this planned pumping operation would occur, and that the effect of this pump test that the company did was to, in effect, draw the contaminants from the land into the water supply, or was it perhaps already in the groundwater, so to speak, or is that not known right now?
Well, it's not 100% sure. Basically, what was happening was the contamination was on what is now known as the Just Cause site, and there had been concerns raised at public hearings that there was the potential for contamination on the adjacent site, and people spoke to DES and said, you know, we're concerned that when this drilling starts, the way such a large withdrawal will have the effect of pulling water towards the drilling operation, that there could be, this could happen. And, you know, basically DES is, that's why we have a pump test. So for 10 days, they pumped at over 300,000 gallons a day. And during that test, it became apparent that the subsurface water had moved from the Just Cause site onto the USA site and was approaching one of the wells. Whether or not it actually got into the well, that's a whole issue that I'm sure there, you know, as I said earlier, I'm not a scientist, but I just know it was moving. This was in November of 2002. USA Springs didn't tell DES about this until February of 2003. You know, one of the things we've been concerned about is that USA Springs isn't acting like a good neighbor. It would appear to, you know, anyone that if this was happening, when they became aware of it, they should have told DES right away. They waited until they were, had no choice when they were submitting their pump test results. They had to say, oh, by the way, this happened.
And in terms of the aquifer that the company plans to draw from, is there any sense of what communities would be affected or what bodies of water feed from that aquifer, or its general size and scope?
Well, basically, we know that the water from the aquifer impacts down river, for lack of a better term, but towards Durham, Dover, Portsmouth, impacts the Belmy River, which is a primary source for Portsmouth's water supply. Back in the 50s, when Pease Air Force Base was built, the Belmy River was dammed to make a reservoir so that there'd be enough water for Portsmouth. Our concern is that that could be impacted. The Lamprey River, which is already a federally protected for wildlife river, could be impacted. The Lamprey River Advisory Committee went on record in the spring of this year to DES opposing this because of that concern that the Little River, which is a major tributary of the Lamprey, I think it's 12-14%. I mean, it's a big, could in fact be, based on the science they looked at, could at times be actually dried, which would cut back on what went into the Lamprey River. They're all interconnected, which was one of the big things that during the 3 years of discussion on the large groundwater permit, people kept saying, this is like, you know, it could impact Mendham's Pond, then it could impact this, the Little River, the Lamprey River, the Belmy River. And nobody, it appears, wanted to take that seriously. DES initially, when they denied it twice, seemed to be saying they were concerned about those issues. But when the final decision was made in July, their only concern was the contamination, and they ignored everything else.
And I'd like to focus a little bit on the immense profitability of the bottled water industry. At the rate that they could pump under this permit, we're talking, as I mentioned, about 112 million gallons a year, actually a little more than that. And I wonder if you can speak a little bit about the the kind of profit margins that the industry looks at.
Well, my understanding is that in general, a rule of thumb on a bottled water operation is profit of 50 cents a gallon. So the math is, you know, at 66 million a year is the potential profit coming out of this site once it's fully operational. So obviously there's a big incentive for USA Springs Inc. to try to get this thing going. And the concern that obviously we have is, what is the impact on the environment? And in your rush, to make all this money, are you ignoring those impacts? And is DES letting you get away with it? I mean, I think one of the concerns we've had in the last 2 years especially is the feeling that DES wants to be a facilitator to get the permit going. In the beginning, we had the sense that they had told us time after time, that the science was going to determine whether or not there would be a permit. But in the last year and a half, it seems like the science has taken somewhat of a backseat to the idea of what's good for business in New Hampshire. And unfortunately, when you put 50 cents a gallon, which converts to 66 million in these numbers, that's a big chunk. That could be a nice piece of business profits tax that the state might be looking at. And that concerns us, that what are the priorities? The state has an obligation under the public trust doctrine to protect the groundwater, but is that $66 million and its share of the pie maybe blinding them in making good scientific decisions on whether or not this permit should be granted? Obviously, in the case of the large groundwater permit, they granted it with conditions. We're now faced looking at one of those conditions has to deal with the wetlands, and this is going to be a real test of whether or not DES is serious. And when their first step in the public process is to hold a public hearing in Concord the week between Christmas and New Year's, we become quite concerned that, wait a minute, did they just want to get this done with and not have any testimony? Obviously, it didn't work. Quite a few people showed up. But why did they do it in the first place? And that was why we contacted representatives and senators to contact DES and try to either get it canceled outright or at least get an assurance that there would be a second night. Fortunately, we were successful in that, but it still makes us wonder, why did they do it?
And you mentioned the public trust doctrine in terms of protecting the state's natural resources. I wonder if you can say a little bit more about that legal theory.
Well, it's a theory that New Hampshire adopted almost 20 years ago on the water, and specifically got into large groundwater withdrawals in the 1998 legislation. But the public trust doctrine goes back in common law to the Magna Carta in England. I mean, it's a good doctrine. Unfortunately, there aren't that many states in the United States that have adopted it. We're fortunate New Hampshire has, but again, we have to be concerned is how do they implement this doctrine? Do they do it to the detriment of the environment, or do they really look at it objectively? And I think that's our role, to make sure that the state does what it's supposed to. And
I wonder if I can just ask you to say, what does the doctrine actually mean?
It means that the state of New Hampshire has assumed the responsibility for the waters of the state. It's a trade-off from a legal perspective. In some issues, such as, I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head, but you have local control. Here you have the state has primary control of this natural resource, but they have to work with the cities and towns. The cities and towns still can provide for their own local ordinances to protect these natural resources, but the state does have the so-called primacy, and that is the public trust doctrine. And there's where you get into a real delicate balancing act when you have legislation that tries to protect. An example would be a Barrington or a Nottingham from a large groundwater withdrawal, which could, in those communities where there is no public water except wells, how do you protect the homes? Well, one alternative, which was proposed in the legislature, was to give the localities veto power. Well, that doesn't, you know, the problem with that is, it's, as we've been saying, this is not a Barrington problem or a Nottingham problem. This is all of southeastern New Hampshire's problem. So you have to have somebody who has the ability to work with that whole big region, and who's better suited than the state. And with the public trust doctrine, they're able to do that, but they have to be watched closely to make sure that they're actually doing what was intended when the legislature passed these laws. And so that's part of the role of groups like Save Our Groundwater, where we try through our legislative and governmental affairs committee to monitor what's going on in Concord on these issues. Because while we're dealing with this particular permitting process, there are other permitting processes going on which could have a similar impact, and at the same time there were laws being proposed that would either make the public trust doctrine have more teeth or be watered down. So we have to keep an eye on all those things.
You're listening to Making Waves. I'm Brian Gregg, speaking with Bill McCann of the citizens group Save Our Groundwater. Your organization, along with the towns of Nottingham and Barrington, has appealed the State Department of Environmental Services, or DES's, decision to allow USA Springs to withdraw up to 112 million gallons of water a year from a site on the Nottingham and Barrington town line. The state Supreme Court has accepted the case. I wonder if you could speak about the basis of your appeal and when you might expect a decision.
Well, the basis of the appeal is multi. Obviously, there are issues that were raised during the course of the large groundwater permitting process. One of the things which I think is fundamental to our case is the fact that DES has treated this permit like a local zoning ordinance. They haven't had expert witnesses come in. There's not been an adjudicative hearing to review what USA Springs Inc. consultants say the impact of the large groundwater withdrawal will be. There has not been an opportunity in a forum where there's cross-examination for Nottingham's experts to come in, or for Save Our Groundwater to bring in an expert and let USA Springs cross-examine and let us cross-examine. That's the first real serious problem. The other is we believe that there were errors in law made by DES in going through this process. There was no basis for what, at least in our view, of reversing the original decision to deny based on 27 scientific reasons, each of which, according to DES, was enough by itself to deny the permit. After USA Springs asked for reconsideration and went through that last December, DES kind of backed off and said, well, the contamination is the big issue. The other 26 we'll have to look at if and when there's a permit in place. Based on that, USA Springs, Inc. issued or claim they issued a new application. In essence, it was the old application with a new cover sheet. It was submitted in January and in July approved. There were many parts of that process we feel were flawed, that were in violation of the statute that governs, the administrative rules that govern, and those are the basis that Nottingham, Barrington, and Save Our Groundwater went in and asked the court to review it.
I was reading online an editorial written by DES Commissioner Michael Nolan, in which he said that the town of Nottingham, the planning board had at one point, I believe in May of 2001, issued some kind of variance in the zoning that would allow the company to put its plant on a site there that wasn't zoned for commercial or industrial use. Has the town of Nottingham kind of rethought its position on this, or is there some other process going on?
Well, Commissioner Nolan was being a little less than, he was being somewhat disingenuous. Nottingham is not to blame for the current situation. It was a nice chance for them to try to shift some blame at a time when people were still mad at DES for granting the conditional permit. To suddenly go back 3 years and say, well, you know, if Nottingham hadn't done this in May of 01, we wouldn't be here today. The reality is the planning board still has the opportunity to look at what they're proposing. DES still, through the wetlands process, looks at what they're proposing. So Nottingham's decision of 3 years ago didn't seal the fate, as Commissioner Nolan is trying to say, trying to take blame off his agency and put it on a local group of volunteers, which I find, as I say, disingenuous. They did the best they could based on the information they had in 2001. No one at the time knew some of the potential impacts. This was very early in the process. A variance was not something that was necessarily that dramatic. The planning board had held its ground for 2.5 years saying, we're not going to accept your application until you get a permit. Well, now they got the permit, they're dealing with the application. So I think that the commissioner was just simply trying to refocus some local anger at a group of people who didn't deserve it focused on them. I just think he was disingenuous.
Former Governor Gene Shaheen, a Democrat, supported the effort to regulate large groundwater withdrawals in the state of New Hampshire. I'm wondering if there's any impact of this fact. I was reading that in the New Hampshire Business Review magazine that USA Springs, Inc. President Francesco Rotondo considered himself a strong supporter of Craig Benson and was a campaign contributor to Benson in his run for governor last time. Wondering if you have any kind of effect or sense of the, political and financial connections here.
Well, I think clearly the political impact is when Craig Benson ran for office 2 years ago, one of his campaign promises on his website, and he said it many times, was that he wanted to make it a more business-friendly atmosphere in New Hampshire. And he specifically targeted two agencies that he felt were not helping business come to New Hampshire. One was the Department of Labor, which is not surprising, and the other was the Department of Environmental Services. When you have an agency that regulates working conditions, and people want to find ways to get around OSHA and things like that, clearly that's a signal. And when the environment, in the view of a lot of business people, is holding up growth, Mr. Rotondo himself was quoted in either that article that you were mentioning or another one, that, he owned the land, he thought he could do what he wanted on it. Well, there are rules and regulations, and unfortunately, from day one, they came on the land and caused problems with the wetlands, which they shouldn't have done. The environment that Craig Benson preached And people are familiar with the fact that he even had problems at his house with what he did, moving materials that shouldn't have been moved, and DES had told him they shouldn't have been moved, and yet he still went ahead and did it. I think those kind of signals were there that we're going to open this state up for business development, and we don't really care about the environmental impact. We just want to bring in business to New Hampshire. And I think that message kind of, you know, the interim commissioner before Mike Nolan was a gentleman who worked with Governor Benson at Cabletron. You know, a lot of Cabletron people found different positions in the administration. And I think it gave that perception, if not reality, that, hey, if you want to do business in New Hampshire, this administration is going to help you, and we're not going to worry about little things like environmental regulations.
And do you have a sense of whether and how DES might change its approach to USA Springs when the agency is led by an appointee of Democratic Governor-elect John Lynch?
Well, I think Governor-elect Lynch has, and he very early on in the process, even before the general election, but back during the primary, Mr. Lynch put out some positions regarding large groundwater withdrawals, expressing some of the concerns that we have, and actually proposed, since there is a statutory committee that's looking at the issue, a moratorium until that report was in, which I think was at least a good first step. I feel in the fact that I think in discussions with some of the people who worked with the governor-elect, I think that his attitude is going to be, I want to take a look at what's here. I don't want to stifle development, but I want to make sure we have development that is doesn't impact the environment. I've always sensed in what I've seen of John Lynch in the last few months as he was running that he is the type of pragmatic person who is going to look at the impact on the environment, but is also going to look at what's good for growth in the state. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive. I think one of the problems we had with Governor Benson was he took the position they were, and that business growth certainly was more important than environmental regulation. I believe, and I believe John Lynch does also, that we can have that balance and have good, clean development in the state without ruining our environment.
And just a word about the company USA Springs itself. The name might suggest that it's a national company with, you know, many sites and plants or whatnot. I wonder if you can say what you know about the nature of this company itself.
Well, in fairness, we don't know a lot. We know that the company has its world headquarters in Pelham, New Hampshire, in a ranch house. That's supposed to be where their office is. They're Dun and Bradstreet says they do, I think it's $150,000 a year in gross sales, but I'm not sure in what. I'm not aware of them running any other bottled watering plant. It's a group of investors. The land is owned by a realty trust, Garrison Realty Trust, and then you have that adjacent site now, which is the Just Cause Realty Trust. So who actually owns the assets is somewhat up in the air. We can only go by what Mr. Rotondo said in the Business Review and a couple other places where he's been quoted, that he has investors. And I am not aware that they have any expertise in the bottled water industry. I also understand that the biggest lobbying group, the International Bottled Water Association, that USA Springs, at least the last time I checked, is not a member of that organization. So I don't know what, you know, how much expertise they have, and some of the information they've given to Nottingham in getting into the nitty-gritty of building the bottled watering plant makes me wonder if this is their first one, because there seems to be inconsistencies that if you were, in my view, if you were familiar with bottled watering, you'd have a good idea that, you know, if you got 175,000 square foot plant, the interior design would be more than 137,000 square feet. So, you know, inconsistencies like that make me wonder just how knowledgeable they are in the, or are they just a group of people who are, look at that $66 million potential profit and say, hey, let's give it a try.
The public still has a chance to make its voice heard in the USA Springs case. Along with a permit from DES, the company would need the approval, as we mentioned, of the Nottingham Planning Board before it could build its proposed pumping and bottling plant. The Nottingham Planning Board has scheduled a public hearing on the project for January 19th. Also on the calendar there, DES has scheduled another public hearing after considerable public pressure for a more convenient time and place following last Tuesday's hearing in Concord. This one is set for January 26th in Nottingham. Bill McCann, one last question. If people in the area want to find out more about SOG, Save Our Groundwater, where would they go to look?
Well, the best place would be to go to our website, www.saveourgroundwater.org. There is all kinds of information there. There's history so that people who are not familiar with what's transpired in the last year especially or even further back can look on the website. There are copies of documents. There are also contact people, myself or other members of the board. And it's I find that we, you know, one of the things we try to do is to give as much information to the public, and this is the best way to disseminate it, is to use this website, and I encourage people to go to it, look at the material. If they've got questions, there are contact information there, and people would be happy to talk to about, you know, what's going on and what can they do to help.
Okay, that's www.saveourgroundwater.org. Bill McCann of Save Our Groundwater, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
My pleasure.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise and put up a parking lot. They took all the trees and put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people a dollar and a half to see them. No, 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 don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise and put up a parking lot. Paradise, put up a parking lot. And now they pay paradise to put up a parking lot. Why not? I heard the screen door swing, and a big yellow taxi took my girl away. Now don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise, put up a parking lot. And now, now, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise, put up a parking lot. Why not? They pay paradise to put up a parking lot. Hey, 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 pay paradise to put up a parking lot. I wanna give it, why you wanna give it, why you wanna give it all away? Hey, 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 now you wanna give it.
That was Counting Crows with their remake of the Joni Mitchell classic, Big Yellow Taxi. Well, that's about all the time we have for the Making Waves program. Now that 2004 has ended and we at Making Waves have just completed our 12th show, we are especially wanting to hear from you, our listeners. We are making plans for where the show will go from here and need your input. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you like, what you don't like, and what you want to hear more of, and other suggestions. Also, to hear our previous shows, you can visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com, that's freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. If you or people you know aren't always in range of the station on Saturdays, you can go to www.wirenh.com/radio, where The Wire has been generous enough to create space for WSCA to stream audio live. Remember that WSCA is new and growing, and hoping for your membership and participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. And be sure to tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program here on WSCA 106.1 FM. We'll be exploring nuclear issues, power, weapons, and activism against them, which the Seacoast has a rich history of. We leave you with this quote: "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing." That was Edmund Burke.